It seems like it's been a long time since we've been here, right? In the church. Yeah, I don't know how long. Quite a while. Anyway, it's nice to see everybody. Thank you for coming. And thanks to everybody online for being here. We'll start with the homework that we had from last week. A few comments, if anybody has any. I've been impressed so far that people have seemed to be engaging with these little assignments, and they kind of do help, you know, to keep your practice in mind all the time, so that it's not just once a week affair; it's an all the time affair. Anyway, what we said last time is imagine that you're old, and because some people are older than others, and a lot of people in the Sangha are not so old. I'm not that old, I don't think. So imagine that you're very old, and what are the top three pleasures or activities or practices that you imagine will make you happy and sustain you in your old age? And maybe if you think you're old, then maybe you're doing these things now. So some comments, if there are any. We'll start with the room and see if there are any online. Maybe it's better if we put this over there somewhere, right? No? So we can hear comments from the... Okay. Anybody in the room have anything to say?
I can't hear.
So there's a practice, not hearing. Making that into a practice, right? Instead of an annoyance, yeah. Yeah.
The three that I kept returning to through the week were, on the one hand, practice in all its forms, being and serving with friends and family, and playing and listening to live music.
Ah. Yes, Marianne was mentioning that the other day, music and the joy of music, because she plays music in an orchestra. Yeah, music is pretty fantastic. And you don't have to be spry and nimble to listen to music, right? Anybody else in the room? There's Jane, yeah. And then Jeff.
I don't know if this is a practice, but it's in the last several months, I've been very happy to discover that I don't have as much drama in my life as I did when I was younger, or as my younger family members have.
Yes, the absence of drama is a gift, right? Jeff was next.
Well, I find it easier to manifest compassion and kindness as I grew older. And another thing, I really come to value my long-term relationships with people. It's very important to me.
And the older you are, the longer the term relationship is, right?
Right. And I forgot the third. I had some.
Right. But I think it's true that, and you said too, compassion, you know, is a joy. And it maybe is easier when you're older to practice compassion. Maybe it's more natural. You don't have maybe so much you need for yourself, so you want to give. Let's see if there's anybody online. Jeff is our host tonight, so Jeff, if you would call on people whose hands are raised, if there are any. Yeah.
Ready. Good evening, everyone. Well, I've been thinking about making practice my whole life until the very end as my number one practice. My number two thing would be to keep dancing and weightlifting and exercising much more than I ever did before in my life. And hopefully the older I get, the more I'll do, because I'll need to do that. And then the third thing is to do more writing, to have more time to write, particularly haiku and poetry.
Yeah, I hear a lot of older people who say that they're writing now and they didn't have time before, and that the writing is giving them a lot of pleasure. Yeah, that's great. And when you're practicing, you know, you're really attentive to your inner life, so there's probably a lot of things to notice and write about.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. One or two more online, if there are any. I see Candy Lowe is raising her actual fleshly hand, and it happens to be on the first page that I can see. And so is Martha raising her actual hand. So let's hear from Candy and Martha, and then we'll end.
Good morning, or good evening, everybody. I have recently, some friends have recently run into some real problems, elderly people, and they desperately needed some help. And so I've been staying with them about every other day.
Mm.
And I'm learning things that I learned with my, taking care of my husband. I'm learning that, I'm relearning what it means to be compassionate and what it means to be attentive to another people. And I realized when I came home today that my mind was racing, and all the stuff that I used to dither about, I wasn't dithering about when I was with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
I was just at one with their space, zeroed in on what their needs
were. Right.
And now I'm home, and all the little worries are coming back. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm glad I'm going to go back there tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have to worry about myself.
You think I'm helping you, but actually you're helping me, right? Beautiful, yeah. And finally, from Martha de Barros, who just had her 91st birthday the other day. Yeah, happy birthday. You're on mute, Martha, so you'll have to figure out how to, there you go.
But I figured it out. I'm finding that I'm forgetting at a rapid rate and trying to be very affectionate with myself at one of the cousins. I find that everything is a small miracle. You know, the fact that the newt that fell into the dog water didn't drown, you know, the amazing little things that happen that represent life are so extraordinary and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm home every day, all day, mostly alone, and walking outside, which is beautiful these days. And I don't wish for any more. And if I have a lot more, I get flustered and confused. So I think we become, either become very cranky when we get old, or very delicate, very sensitive.
Mm.
Maybe I'm a combination of both.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Martha. Thank you. And I know your place. I know where you live, so I could just imagine you walking outside and seeing the sun and the water, which is beautiful in the sun, yeah.
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 But the Dharma is sustaining me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's what it's for, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Rohatsu final talk at Green Gulch was wonderful and sustaining. So, you know, and your talks, I mean, I keep going back and feeling such gratitude for the practice that we share.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martha. Well, thanks for all of that. Yeah, that's encouraging and happy. So let's go on with our reading of the Dhammapada. So I think we're on a schedule of doing two short chapters a week. So tonight, 12 and 13, two chapters that seem to relate to one another. One is called Oneself, chapter 12, and chapter 13 is called The World. So right away we have to note that this is a subtle thing, because oneself, what do we mean by that? And we're all aware that the Buddha had a lot of doubts about the ordinary idea of self, the idea that most of us commonly hold without really thinking about it. The idea that, which seems so true and so obvious, the idea that we are separate, discrete individuals, not others, not the surrounding environment, and therefore we're very vulnerable, which is why we have to spend a lifetime protecting ourselves and fretting all the time about ourselves. The Buddha thought about this a lot and saw that this deeply and emotionally held concept is really the cause of our suffering. And a lot of what the Buddha taught is how to overcome this concept and see the self for what it really is, a constructed locus for the unimpeachable flow of reality, kind of like what Martha was just saying. When we stop seeing self as me or mine, and instead see it as the way to be in communion with life, see that this, what the self really is life flowing through us. It doesn't belong to us, but it supports us. Then we live trusting the world and trusting our experience. And then it's possible for us to live in this world the way it is, with some ease and appreciation. So this chapter is about self, but it's about that self. It's about guarding and protecting and taking care of that self, not the selfish, small boar, small self, but what Suzuki Roshi called the big self, the big mind. So with that as an introduction, let's read about oneself. Verse 157, if one knew oneself to be precious, one would guard oneself with care. The sage will watch over herself in any part of the night. So yes, oneself in the sense that the Buddha meant the self is a very precious gift. And to do justice to that gift, we have to see the difference between our small scared self that probably always is in need of something or wants something at the expense of someone else, and maybe has a tendency to be thoughtless or unkind, to see the difference between that self and our more expansive self that actually wishes others well and knows that wishing others well and acting on that wish is actually the best and the happiest way to live. And once we have enough awareness, because it takes a certain amount of awareness and kind of clarity to see the difference between those two selves, once we see the difference, and to feel in our hearts and in our bellies and in our minds how clear it is that to do good is really the only thing, the only real way to live, then we start to become naturally focused on our practice, and that brings us a lot of joy. So we follow precepts naturally, and we feel regret and remorse when we hurt other people, as we sometimes will without wanting to. And we try to be on a path of becoming a person of real integrity without making a big deal out of that or, you know, making it into a big something. We just do it because we want to be a person of integrity and we want to be an example of that and a help for other people. So in this verse, the Buddha is making two related points. First, a certain amount of self-restraint is needed in order to become our most magnanimous self. And second, that if you want to help others, the best way to help others is to help yourself first in that way. In other words, to practice, to develop your most magnanimous self. That's actually the best way to help other people. And to me, this is a really important point, because I think it's really important that we share our practice with others when we're called on to do that. And in a way, you know, living is sharing our practice with everything that's around us, whether it's another human being or an inanimate object or a newt. We share our practice. And we do this honestly, based on what we know for ourselves and what we actually practice ourselves, not on the teachings as some external doctrine or dogma, but as something that we really know for ourselves and that we really practice. And this is a big emphasis on Zen practice. When Zen masters complain about intellectual understanding or seem to denigrate the teachings, I think that's what they're talking about. that the teaching should never be a set of external ideas or recommendations or something in the book. You know, they should be always something that we really know for ourselves and that we really live. And then we don't have to make fancy explanations or give advice to anybody. We just need to be honest about who, about ourselves and be kind to others. And in that way, we convey the Dharma. That's what he's talking about in that verse. In first establishing himself in what is proper, I got a little mixed up here. What I was talking about there in terms of sharing the Dharma is the next verses. I somehow got mixed up. In first establishing himself in what is proper and only then teaching others, the sage will not be stained. As one instructs others, so should one do oneself. Only the self-controlled should restrain others. Truly, it's hard to restrain oneself. That's what I was commenting on there. Verses 158 and 159. In verse 157, the part about the sage will watch over herself in any part of the night, I think the sense of that is all the time. Day and night, you're always practicing. You practice even in your dreams, even in your sleep, practices all the time. That's what that's saying. Because it's the whole life, it's our whole life. Everything in our lives is our practice. Okay, so now I think I'm back on the right track here. Verse 160. Oneself indeed is one's own protector. What other protector could there be? With self-control, one gains a protector hard to obtain. And this is a fantastic point. We all need friends and teachers, but who is the number one friend and teacher? The one that ultimately we can trust always? Oneself. You are your own best friend. You are your own teacher. Just as the teachings can't be viewed as something external, not inside you, neither can the teacher or the Sangha be understood as something external that's not inside you. Zen practice is really about a kind of very radical self-reliance, trusting ourselves, our real selves, and our own understanding. So, again, the self that we're trusting is not the willful, scared, small self, but our fundamental Buddha self, our big self. So we're always trying to locate that self within our lives. Of course, you can't exactly locate the Buddha self as if it were a something, or a point of view, or an attitude, or something. It's not an entity, or a template, or a personality. Mostly, what the Buddha self is just letting go of everything that stands in the way and letting yourself enter every moment with open hands. Being in this moment without any of the stuff that you usually use to impede yourself, that's the real self. And that's the self that is completely trustworthy. And no one is more trustworthy to you than that self. And this makes us radically humble. Because compared to the vastness of what we actually are, any one of us, our little self is really quite a modest and pathetic thing, you know, by comparison. No matter who we are and how fantastic we are all subject to the iron law handed down by the Lord of Death. And so in that sense, you know, how great can we be, right? So we're very humble about this vastness that we are. We're humble about our small self. And trusting that true self doesn't mean that we don't need any help, or that we don't need all kinds of assistance. Of course, we need all kinds of assistance. We need teachers, we need friends, We need all kinds of support. Actually, we need everyone and everything in the world. We need a lot of help. But knowing who we really are enables us to receive that help without becoming needy or taking advantage of anyone. When we receive the help we need, we're always amazed and really, really appreciative, knowing that the only one who's capable of living our life is ourself. Nobody can do that for us. Verse 161, by oneself alone is evil done, born of oneself, produced by oneself, it grinds down those devoid of wisdom as a diamond grinds down a gem. And I always say, this is for the time that, now we sort of like take this for granted in a way, but at the time that the Buddha taught this, this is one of his most radical understandings. That despite the truly enormous power of our conditioning, each one of us is responsible for our own conduct in this moment. And that conduct shapes the rest of our lives going forward. And conduct here means body, speech, and mind. So if we act and speak and think unwisely, that will kind of make a mess of ourselves and will grind us down, he says, in the metaphor it says, like a diamond grinds down a jewel. So this is saying, you know, we have all been given from the beginning a very precious jewel. So are we going to take care of it and polish it up, you know, and make it really beautiful, or are we going to allow ourselves by our conduct, our thoughtless conduct, to grind that jewel down into dust? 162, those who cover themselves with their own corrupt conduct, like a creeper covers a tree, do to themselves what an enemy wishes for them. Verse 163, it's easy to do what is not good and things that harm oneself. It's very difficult to do things beneficial and good. So the first verse describes a situation that's really the most common thing in the world. Somebody does something terrible to you, and of course, you retaliate. They hate you, so you hate them too, thinking that that's the thing to do, and in that way you protect yourself against them, you hand them back the same vitriol that they've handed you, and in that way you're standing up for yourself. But the truth is that when you act like this, you are doing exactly what the enemy would wish for. You are diminishing yourself. You are wearing yourself down. You are exhausting yourself with this kind of conduct. The second verse points out that it is very easy to do this. It's what comes naturally to most of us. And most people not only would do this, but would argue for it and say that a person should be like this. It is, on the other hand, so much more difficult to restrain oneself from what the Buddha called the afflictive emotions, which are so corrosive. It's harder to do that, and little by little, with determination, over time, train your heart and your mind to understand and to love rather than that. So the verse in this whole chapter seems to say that it is more difficult, you know, to restrain yourself and practice love than it is to do what comes naturally. But I'm not so sure it actually isn't the opposite. I actually think that it is easier, way easier, to practice than not to. Even though you might think, oh, you got to go and meditate every morning and this and that and the other thing and all these retreats and your legs hurt. It's a lot easier, I think, than the alternative. I always think of the famous story of the bird's nest Roshi, you know, who sat up in an eagle's nest sitting zazen, and if he ever lost his attention, he was going to fall out of the eagle nest and probably kill himself. And somebody down below looked up at him and said, wow, you know, you are really something doing that really hard thing to sit up there and the bird's nest. Roshi said, no, this is easy. What you down there are doing, you know, living in the world as it is without practice, that's really difficult. And I feel that way. I think it's much more difficult. I really admire people who are messed up. It's like, wow, you know, you're so doing that to yourself every day. Good for you. You have a lot of energy and a lot of courage. I could never handle it. I couldn't handle it. Verse 164. The unwise who rely on evil views to malign the teachings of the noble arhats who live the Dharma, produce fruit that destroys themselves, like the kataka reed that dies upon bearing fruit. So there's some plant that, lots of plants actually bear fruit and then they die. So this verse is a kind of special commercial for the Buddha and his disciples, but I think maybe it's a commercial for all spiritual teachers, all spirituality. It's basically saying that among all the terrible things that people do that end up being self-destructive, maybe the worst is when they attack spiritual teachers or spirituality or anything in this world that espouses compassion and goodness and love. And instead of listening to them, and even for 5 minutes, maybe thinking about what they're saying, they preach selfishness and violence instead. And among all the truly terrible things that we can see going on now in our country, it could be that maybe the worst, in a way, is the public elevation of a kind of brutal political rhetoric that expresses scorn for anybody who doesn't agree, and especially scorn for people in need. A lot of people, myself included, are kind of really horrified by this turn of events where this kind of rhetoric is so popular and acceptable. Other people seem to find it oddly refreshing, and they say, well, at least there's no hypocrisy here. People are telling the truth, finally. They're not pretending otherwise. Some people think that way. Well, if truthfulness is a good thing, but I don't know about this kind of truthfulness. If it is truthfulness, it doesn't seem very good to me. I heard one person say, well, hypocrisy at least recognizes the importance of virtue, you know, and pays lip service. You wouldn't be a hypocrite if you didn't say, well, yes, I am virtuous and virtue is worthwhile, even though you're not. So hypocrisy might be better than this, right? Better than this kind of honesty. Somebody, I was reading one political commentator today who said, at least Bush had the decency to lie to the UN. But now, there's the total ignoring of the UN. Maybe it was better to lie to the UN, at least then you recognize the UN exists. Anyway, I would rather if we didn't have either one of those two options, either hypocrisy or this kind of nasty truthfulness, if it is truthfulness. And I hope that the current atmosphere of public discourse will so disgust and wear down so many of us that we will actually eventually have to have some honesty and some morality in public discourse, just as a kind of form of relief from this barrage of attitude. Anyway, that's what this verse is saying. Don't have that kind of attitude. Instead, have the opposite. 165. Evil is done by oneself alone. By oneself is one defiled. Evil is avoided by oneself. By oneself alone is one purified. Purity and impurity depend on oneself. No one can purify another. So this verse reiterates, I think, the theme of this chapter, that we're all responsible for our own lives and our own integrity. Nobody else can do that for us. And it won't do to say, well, I tried, but it was too hard, and the conditions were bad. I had no choice but to do the way I did, you know. No. The most important thing is the condition of our heart, and only we are responsible for that. We're the only ones who can guard our hearts. No matter what the conditions around us are, we never have to abrogate that responsibility. Final verse in the chapter, don't give up your own welfare for the sake of others' welfare, however great. Clearly know your own welfare and be intent on the highest good. So when you first read that verse, you think, what, you know? This is, that's the ultimate selfishness, isn't it? Take care of yourself, don't worry about the other guy. Even if the other guy is in need, make sure you take care of yourself first. Which seems like the opposite of the Bodhisattva path of, you know, total self-forgetfulness and caring for others. But actually, in the light of what we said in the beginning about what self is meant here, these two views are really two sides of a coin. They're really the same thing. We're not talking about protecting the small, needy self. We're talking about protecting and nurturing our Buddha self, our big self. And that big self is non-different from the world and non-different from others. It's not our self. If, based on your small, needy self, you are compelled to go rushing around obsessively and desperately helping, probably in the end, the results won't be great for you or the other people on the other end of your helping. Probably you will burn out and they will say, what a pain in the neck she has been. Not that you should wait until you're a Buddha before you do anything for anybody else. I don't think we need to do that. Perfect our character before we try to do anything for someone else. But it is the most important thing, really, in the end, to take care of our mind, to take care of our heart, to take care of our practice, and to let our helping others come from that place rather than a need somehow to do something. Chapter 13, the world. And here again, the world doesn't exactly mean the world, in the sense of I'm over here, the world's over there, and the world is a big, scary problem that I somehow need to cope with. According to the Buddha, there's no self without world, and there's no world without self. Self and world inter are, like Thich Nhat Hanh likes to say. There's no real difference between them. What we call self and world are just two words to conceptualize what is actually one continuous and seamless experience. From the point of view of practice, what we call the world is basically attachment, enmeshment in what we take to be outside ourselves. The real world is the big self, the true self. Dogen says, you know, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all dharmas that come forward to create yourself. The real world is the ongoing flow of love and awakening that surrounds every one of us. Depending on our understanding and on our conduct, we can either be engulfed by and destroyed by this world, or we can tame the world and make it beautiful, which is how it actually is, if we really see it. one of my books, you know, is called The World Could Be Otherwise. And that's what I meant by that. It would really be a good thing. And I think many of us have a deep hope that one day there would be a world where peace and justice is more or less the rule, and violence and unfairness and brutality would be very rare. I think we all can see a world like that and imagine it, and we can all work toward it, and I think we have to work toward it. Everybody has, I think, a responsibility to work toward it, because what else are you going to do? What else would anybody do but that? But even without a just and peaceful world, the world can be, and actually already is, otherwise, because the world depends on one's own conduct and practice. What the world is and how the world resides within us depends on our own practice and our own conduct. And that's the sort of underlying assumption of this chapter. First verse, 167. Do not follow an inferior way. Don't live with negligence. Don't follow a wrong view. Don't be engrossed in the world. So the main thing in practice, and this is a subtle and very important thing, is pay attention. To be as present as we can be with our life, no matter what state of mind we're in. See, that's the tricky point, because people think, oh, alert means sharp-minded, seeing everything, observing everything, knowing things. But what if, you know, we're sick or we're dull-headed at the moment? No. We're not supposed to be alert and aware unless we're alert and aware. And sometimes when we're not so alert and aware, when we're oblivious, we can still be present, oblivious, and know that we are oblivious. That's just how it is right now. Good, bad, up, down, sharp, dull. It doesn't matter what the state of mind is. It only matters that we're present with that state of mind and we have a feeling of knowing what it is at the time. This is the old Zen saying, one of the great Zen sayings, you know, which are actually like, you know, these like little maxims that your mother taught you, a lot of these Zen sayings. They seem so mysterious, but really they're not that mysterious. Sun-face Buddha, moon-face Buddha. That's what that saying means. Sometimes, you know, sun-face, vital, you know, on it, aware, sometimes moon-face, very fading away. Either way, it's a Buddha. In other words, either way, we can be present and aware. So that's the way we can be in the world without being swamped by the world. To simply, if we're stressed out, be a stressed out Buddha. Know what that feels like. Be present with it. Don't fight with it. Don't think it's wrong or don't blame it on somebody else. Just be the mind that you are. So pay attention and don't get swept away in the world. 168. Rouse yourself. Don't be negligent. Live the Dharma, a life of good conduct. The one who lives the Dharma is happy in this world and the next. Next verse. Live the Dharma, a life of good conduct. Don't live a life of bad conduct. One who lives the Dharma is happy in this world and in the next. So when you live that way, when you're present, and when you're willing to be, you know, a mess when you're a mess, because sometimes we're a mess, right? Then you can be happy. And practice is fundamentally a path of happiness. Buddha starts his journey with suffering and the end of suffering. That's the whole path. and of suffering means happiness and ease. The Buddha saw, you know, quite radically, that to be human is to be broken and in need of healing, and that healing is possible and happiness is possible. In this life and the next, as the verse says, means that not only are we happy here and now, but that the virtue, the power of our happiness has reverberations throughout the universe, long into the future. So this means that we're being happy not just for ourselves. Our happiness isn't that kind of happiness, the kind of happiness that we selfishly guard. Our happiness is nothing to be guarded because it's shared. It's a shared happiness. It's not for ourselves alone. It spreads outward from us, beyond us. Verse 170, if one sees the world as a bubble, if one sees it as a mirage, one won't be seen by the king of death. So that's a challenging verse, and a beautiful one. It's a little like the Heart Sutra, isn't it? All dharmas are empty. Everything is a mirage. It's not real. It's not substantial. The world is not the hard and fast world that we think it is. And in Buddhism, there are so many expressions like this. See the world as a mirage, an illusion, something conjured up by a magician, you know, in the county fair, a bubble, a flash of lightning, a drop of dew that, you know, is gone. The Diamond Sutra says all of that at the end. And the Lojong slogans say it. All the Mahayana sutras say stuff like that. It doesn't mean that the world is an illusion in the ordinary sense, because an illusion means there's something real. This is an illusion, therefore something else is real. Maybe God is real or Buddha is real, but this is an illusion. But it doesn't mean that. It means there are no exceptions to this illusion. There's no contrast to this illusion that's real. Everything is an illusion. That changes the whole idea of what illusion is. So here, illusion doesn't mean false or incorrect or unreal compared to something else that's true, correct, and real. It means that which we live is light, easy, and beautiful, rather than heavy and intractable. Things seem really heavy. We say, this is a heavy time, and we suffer under the weight of them. But actually, things are not heavy. They are light. And yes, we have our feelings about them, but when we know the world is illusion in this sense, then we understand our afflictive emotions and we're able to release them, or anyway, not take them so seriously, and certainly not act out on their basis. Because our feelings are also illusions in just the same sense. When we understand this, the verse says, then the Lord of Death cannot see us. We are invisible to the Lord of Death. Because if life is an illusion, death is also an illusion. And when life and death are an illusion, the Lord of Death cannot see us. The Lord of Death can only see us when we live the life that we think is real and the death that we're frightened of. 171. Come, look on this world as a beautified royal chariot. Fools flounder in it, but the discerning do not cling. And I think in one of the previous verses, Gil used the word beautified in the sense of to doll something up, you know, put a lot of nice paint on it and furnish it real nice. It's a horrible house. It's falling down, but with a nice furniture and a good paint job, it can look pretty good. The chariot is made up to look fancy and luxurious, but really it's not such a great deal. It's nothing special, nothing that we need to desire or glom onto. Foolish people are enticed by this beautified chariot and they get caught up in it, but the wise know better and they stay on their feet. Verse 172. Whoever recovers from doing evil by doing something wholesome illuminates the world like the moon set free from a cloud. Whoever replaces an evil deed with what is wholesome illuminates the world like the moon set free from a cloud. Blind is this world. Few see clearly here. As birds who escape from nets are few, few go to heaven. So these verses are, I think, making it really clear that the path is a path of ethical conduct, of doing what is good and not doing what is bad. So the first thing then we need to do is be able to tell the difference. And sometimes people can't tell the difference. Next, we have to know for ourselves how immensely important it is for us to do what is good and not what is bad. It's not just a personal matter or a trivial matter. It's very, very important. And then we have to do it. We have to do what's good and avoid doing what's bad and learn how to do that and take care of ourselves in the process. And this is something that is not imposed from the outside. It's something that comes from the inside, from our own knowing. More or less, you know, what is good and bad in Buddhism? It's, you know, more or less, because we don't have in Buddhism a God, external God who ordains, I'm telling you, this is good and this is bad. If you want to know, just look it up. We don't have that. We only have our practice and our own hearts. So good means that which causes happiness for ourselves and those around us. And bad is the opposite, that which causes suffering and misery. That's what's bad. And the image of the moon set free from a cloud, which appears in the first two of these verses, is really important because what it's trying to tell us is that our hearts and our minds are basically attuned to the good. That's their nature. Goodness is natural to us. It's the default position. The bright moon is an image of our natural mind. It's always up there shining. But because of ancient twisted karma, the moon gets covered over, obscured by clouds. And maybe the clouds are really, really, really thick, and we would doubt that there's a moon behind them at all. But there is. So to practice, we don't have to manufacture a moon. We just have to blow the clouds away, so that the moon that's already there shining can be seen. And this reminds me of a really important piece of wisdom that I heard yesterday from Roberta. Maybe you know Roberta, one of our Everyday Zen priests. She reminded us yesterday that the ice guy who so horrifically, seemingly, for no reason, I mean, they say there are reasons, but it seems like not really, shot this young woman, Renee Nicole Good. Such a shocking thing. But Roberta reminded us that this guy was himself a very traumatized person. He had been in the Iraq War, which was a very nasty thing. God knows what people experienced in that situation. And then he came back and became an ICE person, and I think already was in one incident where he was almost run over by a car, or maybe was run over by a car. So he was, you know, you can imagine his state of mind, right? Lots of clouds obscuring the moon, the bright, kind moon of his heart. So stuff like that happens. And who's to blame? Verse 175. Swans travel the path of the sun. Those with psychic powers travel through space. The wise travel forth from the world, having conquered Mara and his army. The Buddha recognized the possibility of all kinds of special enlightenment experiences that would give you all kinds of special powers, psychic powers and miraculous powers. You see in the Buddhist literature lots of references to this. But this was not the path that the Buddha recommended or followed. The Buddha's path was, like we're saying, a path of simple goodness and happiness. The goal of the Buddha's path is not to master the world. The goal is to be able to walk peacefully in the world, as it really is, with a heart of kindness. The end of the chapter, I'm skipping a couple verses to read the last verse, which also expresses this. In this verse, it mentions stream entry, which is a kind of technical term that more or less refers to someone who has truly and indelibly entered the path, so much so that they can never, ever go back. Their commitment is beyond any ability to backslide. So absolute rule over the earth, going to heaven, supreme sovereignty over all the worlds, the fruit of stream entry surpasses them all. And then going back to the verses we missed, for people who speak falsely, who transgress the way, who transgress in this one way, and who reject the world beyond, there is no evil they won't do. Fools don't practice generosity. Misers don't go to the world of gods. The wise rejoice in generosity and so find happiness in the hereafter. So it's kind of interesting that these verses, just toward the end here, bring up two practices within all the many, many things that could be mentioned. These verses want to bring up two practices specifically that for some reason in this context the Buddha wants to emphasize. And the two are honesty, or lack of honesty, and generosity, or lack of generosity. Speaking falsely, which seems in the verse to be connected to not recognizing the power and reverberations of one's actions, is a particularly bad thing, it seems like this verse implies. Because if you see the world as a contest to gain or lose advantage, then you will say or do whatever it takes, right? Whatever it takes to get advantage and not ever be disadvantaged, because you think that's the way the world is. It's only natural that you would do that. A person like this really will stop at nothing. And that view, in a way, is the exact opposite of generation. That's generosity. That's saying the world is small and crabbed and we've got to elbow each other out. But generosity is saying, no, the world is very, very large. We don't need to do that. It's very miserable, I would think, to see the world like that. Miserable and scary and hard to get any rest, any peace. Generosity is the practice of bodhisattvas, which makes them happy now, because they're practicing generosity and feeling it, and in future times. Their generosity has a great and expansive scope, even beyond what they can see and feel. And of course, the first of the six paramitas, the gateway to the bodhisattva path, is generosity. So it's kind of interesting that here at the end, the Buddha mentions those two things in particular. So we're about to do groups, but before we do that, I want to just say a few things just in case folks online will drop off some of them. First, I would like to say that on January 25th at Book Passage here in Corte Madera in the county, Denise Newman, who, I don't know, is Denise still here? Are you still here, Denise? You were before. She's a master poet and teacher of poetry and a wonderful writer, and she's going to be reading poetry at Book Passage on the 25th of January, which is a Sunday afternoon, with Alice Jones. So I wanted to remind you of that, to put it in your calendar. And it would be great to have a big audience to come and hear her read. And I'm sad to say that I will not be in that audience because I won't be here on January 25th. I'm going back to Mata Hari, where I'm going to do a retreat with, I've been working for a long, long time with Gary Friedman, who trains people from all over the world in conflict resolution. And we use meditation and Buddhist practice to help people learn about conflict resolution. So I'll be down in Mexico in a week's event doing that. So I'll be here for seminar next week on the 21st. And on the 28th, Kathy will take care of the seminar. And on the 25th, in between those dates, will be the reading. And I've been thinking that, I don't know if you're having a good time studying the Dhammapada, but it's nice to be able to study it, you know, go through it so slowly, word by word and verse by verse. So I was thinking that maybe we just continue like we're going, two verses each week until we're done, which would be early March. And then after that, we can study a little Dogen so we don't forget about Dogen. And then at the end of March, we're going to have our annual practice period later than usual because we couldn't get dates for Sesshin at Via del Maria del Mar. So how do you say it? Via Maria del Mar until May. So we sort of put the practice period later. So it's going to start the very end of March, and it's going to go till the very end of May. And our Enos are working on scheduling and stuff like that, and word will go out in a while, in a little while. And the last point, homework. Here's the homework assignment. Oh, there's Denise. Hi, Denise. Yeah, I'm sorry I can't make your reading, but thank you for the book. It was wonderful to read. Let's see, homework. Okay, let's pay attention this week to those last two points that for some reason the Buddha felt it was important to mention. Speech and generosity, and see maybe we can see connections between them. So that means just notice the quality of your ordinary everyday speaking. Just notice, to what extent is it expansive and generous and kind, and to what extent is it, you know, impatient and crabby. Notice the feeling of generosity or lack of it as you go through your day. So notice your speech and notice whether you're feeling generous and expansive or contracted during the day, and then maybe next week we'll have some things to say about that. Okay, so those are the things I wanted to say before the groups, and now it's time for our groups of three. And in the group of three, and we'll do it in the
recording
room,
recording stopped,
and we'll also do it online. Jeff will put people in groups of three. Let's talk about this question of ethics and morality, which is so important in this chapter. Self, world, ethics and morality is what self and world are all about, right? So the question is there a difference between the way that you previously conceived of ethical conduct and morality and the way you see it now? Let's say maybe from decades ago or childhood and the way you see it now. And is there any influence of the Buddhist practice on this? Has that influenced you in any way?